episode 921, our favorite episodes. What was this one called? The Strange Case of Dr. Watson and Mr. Holmes. Another time loop, everybody, but don't worry. It's good, right, Ben?
Yeah, but two in a row?
Welcome to the Sci-Fi Christian. Well, yeah, I mean, like I said, I've wanted to listen to these, What better way to listen to them than to put them into our feed and have everybody else do it? So as I mentioned in the last episode, listeners, I just finished reading the book series. I just finished watching the BBC series. I've been reading other Sherlock-related material and watching other Sherlock-related material. I've been thinking about... I found out some of the old movies that you like. And
yeah, the Basil.
Yes, they're available on Prime, I believe.
They're great.
So
a lot of them are short.
Throw out just one recommendation, one that comes to mind.
Oh,
that you like.
Gosh, I don't even... I mean, they're all...
I can check your letterbox,
They're probably all pretty interchangeable, to be honest. But it's... honestly, they're so short that they're probably comparable length to most of the BBC series. You could almost look at them as episodes.
Yeah. You know, speaking of the BBC series, I had always... viewed that series as, in some ways, you know, every season had three hour and a half length, basically movies. I sort of saw them as independent stories. Of course, you have the continuing Watson and Holmes relationship, but I don't think I realized until I binged watched them. It doesn't really hang together well as a series, so much so that I almost feel bad logging on Letterboxd as a movie because it is ongoing
TV series.
Yeah, it is an ongoing TV series. But
I don't think you need to feel guilty.
it had some great moments. It kind of goes out with a whimper instead of going out with a bang. Do you agree?
I've never watched the last season.
Yeah, you hated that Abominable Bride Christmas episode.
Hated it. It made me angry.
Man, so you think you'll ever go back?
Never say never again.
Technically, they never canceled that show. It's on hiatus, just like The Life Report.
It's true. They have that in common. And they also both went out with a whimper. I mean, we did that book.
The history. No, the history of Christianity. I think those were the last episodes.
Oh, maybe. Really? I thought it was the book.
The John Stott.
But,
yeah, what was that book about?
It
was
I don't know.
Disciplines?
We probably did as many episodes on John Stott as we've done on Moby Dick.
Wow. Yeah.
And that's depressing.
So, Ben, tell us about episode 330. We recorded this back in 2015. It looks like we released it on February 5th, 2015. The Strange Case of Dr. Watson and Mr. Holmes. It's something I remember just being fascinated by your episode, even though I hadn't even read the books yet. So,
I think I was envisioning a theory where Holmes and really exists, and then Watson is a figment of his imagination.
Yeah, are they one
and
the same?
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
And there's some... perhaps interesting evidence in that direction.
And you, even if you don't remember now, your past self does remember. So hit that time travel music and we'll make this happen, Captain.
Episode 330, The Strange Case of Dr. Watson and Mr. Holmes.
Welcome to the Sci-Fi Christian, bringing you theology at warp speed. I'm Matt Anderson.
And I am Ben DiMoto, and we are back
for an episode that I have been looking forward to for quite some time.
Yeah, so when you did the first Sherlock episode, right around there, I said, I have an idea for another Sherlock alternative reading. And I said, if you want to hear that, because I don't want to be repetitive, but if you're interested, send me an email and just say, I want to know more about that. I forgot that I had said that, and so I started getting emails that just said, I want to know more about that, and I had no clue what they were referencing. And then I finally figured it out. I was like, people want the Sherlock episode. Yeah.
Yeah. So why don't you just tell them what the title of the podcast we just called this episode means.
Oh, so it's a reference to the Robert Louis Stevenson novel, The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, of course, being ultimately, this is kind of a surprise ending, the same person.
Spoilers for like 100 years ago.
At least. I am going to make the argument, I'm going to present a reading in this episode that looking at the original Sherlock stories, you can make the case that Dr. Watson and Mr. Holmes are in fact the same person. This is in line with the earlier episode that we did on the cult of Sherlock, in which I gave a reading of the Sherlock canon as a religious text. And I went at great length at the beginning of that episode to explain the concept of secondary readings. I'm not going to get into that as much today,
Do you want me to look up when that episode was?
Yeah, we should find out when it is so that people can know about it. But the very brief synopsis, a secondary reading would simply be a reading that is not what the author originally intended. It's acknowledged that way up front, but it's simply an alternative way of looking at the stories in order to, play around with interpretation and stretch your literary critical muscles and try and make the evidence fit something other than what the author originally intended. And do you know what I discovered after we did The Cult of Sherlock, Matt?
What?
That this is actually something that Sherlock fans have been doing for over 100 years.
Doing what?
These types of secondary readings with the Sherlock canon. There's actually, it's called the Sherlockian game or the Great Game.
Okay.
And it started in 1911. And the basic concept is that people play this game and you treat the Sherlock stories as though they are actual historical documents, and you apply higher criticism to them in the same way that you might the Bible or other ancient documents or something like that to try and figure out the real story behind the text. So you treat them as though they're real and then apply actual, hermeneutical methods to them to try and develop these different readings.
Wow.
So people like Dorothy Sayers, who is a mystery writer and was friends of Lewis and Tolkien, was a big fan of the Sherlockian game, and she said that it must be played as solemnly as a county cricket match at Lord's. The slightest touch of extravagance or burlesque ruins the atmosphere. So we're actually, unbeknownst to me, I had no idea that this was out there until after we did The Call to Sherlock, and then I discovered we're part of this grand Sherlockian tradition.
Wow.
So how about that?
That's awesome. And so before we dive into today's conversation, it sounds like you're saying go listen to that episode first just to get a context. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think if you're confused about the idea of secondary readings and what we're doing, you at least listen to the start of that episode.
So that episode is episode 287. As Ben said, it's called The Cult of Sherlock.
But beyond that, none of the material in this is dependent on the material in that episode.
Okay.
So as long as you understand the concept of what we're doing, you don't have to listen to that episode to enjoy this one.
Perfect. So just dive in, because I've been excited about this for months. That episode came out back in September.
Yeah.
So I've just been waiting. How
are they the same person?
How are they the same?
Well, I think it's worth noting that, of course, this is referring to the Arthur Conan Doyle canon.
Yes.
So this may apply more or less well to different adaptations, including the BBC series. But there would be evidential problems that would come in with trying to do, for example, that series that don't come in with the original canon. So I'm geared towards the original canon. That said, if your only exposure to Sherlock is an adaptation, you should be able to follow along well, because the conventions of Sherlock Holmes are such that you're not going to be lost as long as you have a basic understanding of the character.
Perfect.
So the way I thought we would do this is I want to lay out a few foundational pieces of evidence. And then I want to just kind of walk through the timeline of Watson and Sherlock's careers as it's presented in the short stories and the novels, because I almost feel like a narrative approach is the way to tell this story.
Okay, yes.
It really is much heavier in narrative than the secondary reading that we did before. If I ever get around to it, perhaps I'll even write this out in a narrative format, because I think it would lend itself quite well to a novel form and be quite an interesting exercise in literary criticism in that way.
And let me ask you this quick question before you dive in. Have you heard anybody else give this reading of Sherlock that you're about to say?
I have not.
So this could be a Ben DeBono original. Maybe you should write this out
someday. Maybe. Yeah, so you're not allowed to steal this, everyone. Okay. So several foundations that, before we get into the actual narrative itself, are prevalent throughout the text. The first one is the concept of the unreliable narrator. Virtually all the stories are written by Dr. Watson. Remember that for the sake of this conversation, we're assuming that he is in fact a real person, and Arthur Conan Doyle would merely be the compiler.
Okay. Right?
So Dr. Watson is the narrator. Now, we know he's an unreliable narrator. And we, at least to some extent, we know this for several reasons. First, details will change and one of which I will get to in just a second, very significant about Dr. Watson's war wound. The details on that change frequently. We also know that Sherlock Holmes chides him in several of the stories for his embellishments of the narrative, which means that even within the canon itself, there's a level of untrustworthiness to the stories. It suggests that what you are getting in the written narrative is different than what actually happened. That's very significant. That opens the door to this type of reading. It suggests that there is more than meets the eye.
Okay.
There's also the issue of Dr. Watson's wound, in that it shifts location in different stories. At times, it is a bullet lodged in his leg. Other times, it is referred to as being in one of his limbs. Other times, it is in his shoulder. His wound that he's, because he served in the Afghanistan War, as a army doctor. And the curious shifting nature of this wound is something that gives many players of the Sherlockian game pause, because you would think that since Dr. Watson is narrating his story, that he would have a proper knowledge of where his wound is.
Yes, he would.
Now, it's possible that he could have multiple wounds, but that seems unlikely, because he would have referred to them all at once when he first introduces the concept of his wound. The wound is always singular. That's significant.
Interesting.
For the sake of this reading, I'm going to suggest that the wound is entirely, or at least in large part, psychological. That it could be psychosomatic, in the sense that there are psychological conditions manifesting themselves in a physical form, which, interestingly enough, is the interpretation the BBC series takes of Watson's wound. You remember the first episode?
Yes.
He's walking around with the cane. Yes. Watson's wound is psychosomatic. However, taking that the canon takes place in the late 1800s, before we have modern terms like PTSD and some of our other modern psychological terminology is well known, I think it's highly likely, in the case of this reading, that Dr. Watson is actually wounded psychologically, either due to some traumatic experience in the war or simply because of the culmination of all that he experienced. This manifests itself possibly at times in a psychosomatic way, but primarily in a psychological way that eventually leads to a splitting of his personality and the Sherlockian personality emerging within him.
So Watson is the original.
Watson is the original.
Sherlock
person.
Is his alternate.
That's right. Now, another curious piece of evidence is Watson's relationship with his wife, or perhaps I should say his wives.
Uh-oh.
Now, if you're thinking, wait a second, Ben, it's very clear in the canon that Watson only has one wife. He meets Mary Morstead in The Sign of the Four. It is heavily implied that they are married several times after. Watson makes several references to his wife from that point on. Open and shut. Not so fast. Actually, this is a large point of contention among Sherlockian scholars. People estimate that Watson actually has as many as six wives throughout the canon.
Why?
Well, number of reasons. First of all, he never refers to her by name again after The Sign of the Four, which, by the way, is the second novel written very, very early on in the canon.
Okay.
Any reference to his wife is exactly that, my wife. He never mentions her name after.
Okay.
Second interesting piece of evidence is that Watson at various times seems to be living back at Baker Street. There are times where he's very clearly living with his wife, whoever she may be at the time, but there are other times where he's very clearly living back again with Sherlock Holmes. His residency changes. But really the real clincher, and remember, we're taking this as though it's historical documents, is that the details of his wife change rather dramatically. She's referred to as being an orphan at one time and visiting her mother in another story.
Okay.
That's only possible if the good doctor has multiple wives.
At the same time or?
At different times.
At different times.
He has a cycle of marriage and divorce throughout the series.
Okay.
Now, that could have an innocent explanation, but yet it seems suspicious. Remember, this is the late 1800s, and while divorce isn't exactly unheard of, getting married six times is, I mean, that's quite extravagant even in today's world, much less in the late 1800s. What is it about Dr. Watson, who otherwise appears to be a relatively stable, respectable, gentlemanly individual, that causes his marriages to, and morally upstanding too, we should add. He is Sherlock's conscience throughout the series. What is it about Dr. Watson that causes his marriages to so frequently break up? I would posit that for the purpose of this reading, it's the fact that his insanity comes to the forefront and eventually breaks up his marriages.
And she has to leave.
She has to leave. It could be that he goes back to Baker Street even while he's married, and that eventually forces a break in the marriage. He's only able to stay with her for a while. And we know, here's the real curious thing about his relationship to Baker Street, is that during the Great Hiatus, the period where Sherlock is supposedly dead in Watson's mind, mm-hmm. you know, after he goes over the falls with Moriarty, and Sherlock's in hiding at this point. But according to Watson, in the canon, Sherlock is dead. Watson maintains the residence at Baker Street, even though he's not living there. Very curious.
That is curious. Why would he do that?
I don't know. And it's even more curious if you consider how he and Sherlock supposedly met. They met because Watson needed a roommate. Apparently not. Apparently he's plenty wealthy enough as it is to maintain two separate residences, even when Sherlock isn't around. If he could do that during the Great Hiatus, there's no reason he wasn't doing it all along. All right?
I don't know what to say. This is crazy.
The final one.
Now, at the end of this, I'm going to ask you what you actually make of this from the author perspective. Like, why would the author have these seemingly mistakes in here? So,
well, they're mistakes. I mean, he just wasn't writing that carefully.
Oh. Spoilers. Spoilers for the end of the conversation.
Sherlock is also a master of disguise, to the point where Watson even doesn't recognize him at times. That, to me, you could take that as a number of ways. Obviously, within this reading, if it is Watson and Sherlock are the same person, it can't be exactly as it's presented in the text. But it could be times where the Sherlock personality takes over so thoroughly that it completely blocks Watson out. He comes to, looks in the mirror, and sees a disguise that is so completely foreign that he's unrecognizable. In any case, that's not really an important point. The more important point with Sherlock being the master of disguise is you wonder, how does he fool people so much? How does he pull this off? Well, it's quite obvious that he's able to easily trick people. Sherlock is certainly a character who's not above theatrics. There's no reason why, when meeting with prospective clients or trying to trap a villain, he couldn't pay somebody to dress up as Watson or dress himself up as Watson or Sherlock or some combination of the two to make it appear as though there are really two men in the room.
That actually kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
That's why he has all these different disguises, because they're actually just different actors.
Yes. Now,
and sometimes he'll play Watson and sometimes he'll play Sherlock.
Exactly. But it's even more important to know that people, even though Sherlock becomes very famous throughout the history, people don't recognize him. Remember, we're talking the late 19th century. Photography is very, very low tech. There's no television. There's really no radio at this point. There's no internet. There's no nothing. This is where this is a piece of evidence you'd have to deal with quite differently if you wanted to apply this reading to the BBC series, because of the presence of all of those mm-hmm. things. But there's only a small circle of people, even within the canon, who know what Sherlock looks like. That's very significant. The amount of people that he would have to have taken in, have convinced not to spill the beans, to have in on it, is incredibly small.
So do you think Watson has asked people to keep this secret, or do you think he doesn't even realize what's happening? Does he realize there's two people?
He eventually does.
Sorry, does he realize there's one person? Or?
Yeah, Watson does eventually.
Okay.
And that's going to be important.
Are we covering Mrs. Hudson also?
No, she'd have to be somebody who's in on it, though. Mrs. Hudson is a very small figure in the canon, but fairly easy to do. Inspector Lestrade is the more significant figure, the contact with the police force. And there's a few contacts with the police force who would have to be in on it.
Okay.
However, given the genius of the Sherlock personality and the asset that he is to the police force, and the fact that the people who know what he looks like and know him are the few people in the police force who appreciate him, that's not a hard stretch, especially since you could envision their relationship developing exclusively through the Sherlock personality at first, and only having the Watson personality be revealed after they've already realized what an important asset he is. Mm-hmm. And they would have a vested interest in keeping that quiet because he's helped them solve so many cases. And what a scandal that would be if somebody who is clinically insane is getting away with that.
Totally. Okay.
Okay.
This is good stuff.
All right. So let's get to the timeline then. The narrative would start, of course, shortly after Watson returns from the war, where he is wounded, whatever that means in our case, perhaps psychologically. And shortly after this, the Sherlock personality begins to emerge. Now, Watson isn't initially aware of this. Based on a study in Scarlet where Sherlock and Watson first meet, we know that Sherlock has had a career for at least a time before this. We know that he has published a number of monographs, including one on the different types of pipe tobacco ashes. And so he has all these esoteric hobbies that he's been into. But yet Watson doesn't meet him until later in his career. So I imagine that there's a period after Watson returns from the war where he is losing time, where the Sherlock personality emerges for perhaps hours at first, and then eventually days, weeks, possibly even months at a time. Nevertheless, it's not ever a fully dominant personality. It doesn't take over. Rather, Watson slowly begins to become aware that there is someone else there. Now, of course, this would be terrifying. And I think Watson is initially terrified of Sherlock. He certainly finds him bizarre, if not terrified, then angry about what is happening. He doesn't like Sherlock Holmes at first. They later become very good friends. But upon first meeting him, he scoffs at one of the articles that Sherlock has written at the beginning of A Study in Scarlet. He finds Sherlock off-putting and peculiar. There is an initial tension in this relationship. Now, that could be interpreted as simply getting to know a mutual friend. But it's also curious that for two roommates, they don't know each other at all before they begin lodging with each other. Watson doesn't take the time to get to know Sherlock Holmes and find out some of these quirks. And if he had, he likely wouldn't have roomed with him because he finds him so unpleasant. Why does Watson room with him so quickly? Why doesn't he leave him when he decides he doesn't like this guy? Well, the obvious answer is he can't.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Sherlock personality is one and the same with him. Now, it quickly becomes obvious to Watson that he doesn't know how to wholly do away with the Sherlock personality. That becomes a very early problem for him. Remember, this is not the age of modern psychology. So he doesn't, you know, even if he wanted to, his recourse for treatment is probably some type of very brutal electroshock therapy, lobotomy, going to the insane asylum. He can't go get help for this. That's very important. And he has enough medical knowledge to know what a futile search that would be. But Watson also is a good man at his heart. He has a strong sense of duty to his country and to his community. And realizing what a wonderful asset the Sherlock persona is, isn't going to be lost on him for long. He's doing good deeds. He is helping people. And so naturally, he decides to allow Sherlock in. He allows him to share consciousness with him, at least partially. And there's times, of course, where the different personalities ebb and flow. One could imagine that during Sherlock's more powerful stages, Watson intentionally allows the Sherlock personality to take over so that he has the unfocused power of the Watson-Sherlock brain.
So, you know, in the Lord of the Rings trilogy, there's that scene where Gollum is talking back and forth to himself. There's a kind of a good one and a bad one. Is that what you imagine? That they're sharing consciousness to the point of they're both coexisting, talking back and forth in that way?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. So they team up. They are together. However, I don't think it all stays quite as hunky-dory throughout the entire career as maybe it seems. There's an internal tension throughout the series of Watson struggling with something of an inferiority complex to Sherlock. Now, that could just be because his friend is a genius, but he never shows true jealousy over the genius part. Rather, but there are times where Watson wants to do without Sherlock. Very curiously, there are times when he insists on doing the investigation himself, often with very disastrous results. That's just silly, given what we know about those two earlier. Watson is quite comfortable in his role as Sherlock's chronicler and biographer. He knows that he's not Sherlock's equal, and he's quite comfortable with that. What changes before episodes such as The Adventure of the Solitary Cyclist, where we see Watson forcing Sherlock to allow him to go off and do part of the investigation? I think Watson, at this point, has been through at least a couple of marriages, realizes that Sherlock is causing him problems in his life, and because of that, decides he wants to shut down the Sherlock personality.
Or maybe he wants to know that without Sherlock, he could still do good.
One or both. Yeah. Whenever this happens, though, it goes horribly. And Sherlock doesn't just excuse the failure. He berates Watson for his failures of investigation, which is very curious that if it mattered that much to him, why he allowed Watson to do it in the first place. Well, I think in a show of psychological strength, Watson pushes the Sherlock personality down and is able to take over temporarily. When he realizes his failure, his shame, his embarrassment, his sense of ineptitude, all play factors that allow in Sherlock to reemerge to the forefront. A very notable example is The Hound of the Baskervilles, the famous third novel in the Sherlock canon, where for reasons that are very peculiar and really have nothing to do with the case, Sherlock and Watson separate for the vast majority of the novel. He sends Watson off alone on this for reasons Watson doesn't understand. He stays in London. After a time, he does come up to where Watson is investigating, but even then, for a long time, he's in disguise. He's behind the scenes. It very much lends itself to somebody who is having trouble emerging, but yet still wants to be solving this case, still wants to be doing the good. And of course, eventually, Watson isn't able to solve the case by himself. He relies on the Sherlock personality to emerge. So this struggle goes on for some time. And then we get to Moriarty. And this is the big one. Now, do you remember what we talked about with Moriarty in the last episode?
I don't think I remember, other than the obvious that he's Sherlock's equal and opposite.
Yes. Do you remember how often Moriarty appears?
Oh, it was less than you would think, right? One time?
One time. He's mentioned 7 times, but he appears once.
And which one was it?
The Reichenbach Falls.
Okay.
Or whatever it's called. Whatever. It's the one where the episode where he and Sherlock presumably kill each other. Now, to step back from our reading temporarily, I think it's important to note that Moriarty was created for the sole purpose of Arthur Conan Doyle wanting to move his career on from writing Sherlock Holmes stories.
So he wanted this was going to be the last Sherlock
story. Oh, yeah. And that's why there was a long, long pause. Even within the internal chronology, 1891 to 1894 is known as the Great Hiatus.
Okay.
This is the time where Sherlock has supposedly faked his death as a result of having to deal with his nemesis, Moriarty. But the Moriarty adventure is very, very strange. Now, he's grown in his mythological status in later Sherlock adaptations. But if you read the original canon, you'll notice very quickly that the Moriarty episode has an incredibly different feel than every other thing that Arthur Conan Doyle wrote regarding Sherlock. And it's a very synthetic feel. As a standalone, if that's the only one you read, you'll probably love it. And it is well written. But reading the canon straight through, it's very striking how different it feels. And it's also very striking that at the beginning of this story, Sherlock reveals to Watson the shadowy character Moriarty, who has been secretly pulling the strings in the London criminal world for years. He is the Napoleon of crime, as Sherlock calls him. He is Sherlock's arch nemesis. And this is the first time Watson ever hears of him. That strains credulity. that completely strains credulity. It's my... Now, let me back up before I say what I was about to say. We can't claim that Moriarty doesn't exist, though, because that story begins with Watson claiming the reason he is telling the story of Sherlock's death is to clear Sherlock's name because Moriarty's survivors have painted a picture of him as an innocent man who was killed by Sherlock Holmes, framed and killed by him. I would like to suggest that that is the real story. That Moriarty, James Moriarty, is an innocent man. He did nothing. He was framed by Watson for the sake of killing the Sherlock persona once and for all. He is not a criminal mastermind. He did not exist. Watson invented this narrative for his readers, because he is publishing these even within our reading, but primarily for himself. He needed to psychologically convince himself that this had happened, that there was the shadowy figure out there who defeated Sherlock Holmes. And he invents this story. He kills Moriarty. Yes, Watson goes that far to do away with the Sherlock personality. You can imagine how bad things have gotten in his personal life at this point. He frames and kills James Moriarty in order to do away with him and get rid of the Sherlock personality once and for all. And that is why this character strains so much credulity within the canon, why he seems to come out of nowhere, why we never meet anyone like him again, why we've never heard of him before, and why the episode feels so different than all the other Sherlock adventures.
Oh my gosh.
Moriarty, real person, innocent man.
Wow.
Now, Sherlock vanishes from the scene for 3 years, but what's curious about this, remember these dates, 1891 to 1894. Nevertheless, there is a case set in 1892 that features Sherlock. The Adventure of the Wisteria Lodge is set in 1892 and features Watson and Sherlock. The Sherlock personality, even in the middle of this, briefly, very briefly, rears his ugly head and comes back right in the middle. Watson eventually is unable to keep Sherlock down. This is where things get intense between the two. Because Sherlock at this point is obviously not happy at being killed off by his supposed friend, Dr. Watson, for these 3 years. And it's shortly after this that the Sherlock personality turns the tables and does the same thing to Dr. Watson. Now, you might be saying, whoa, wait a second, Ben. Watson never dies in the canon. You're correct. But in the latter half of the Sherlockian canon, we get a pair of stories that are Sherlock supposedly narrating events from the early part of his career. And these are suspicious for a number of reasons. First of all, Watson's not in them, because this is supposedly pre-Watson. I suppose that's possible. We know Sherlock had some kind of career. We could even fit that into this reading, that these happened during Watson's early blackouts. However, I think a far more interesting explanation would be that these actually take place later in the chronology than they are claimed to. This is after Sherlock comes back from the Reichenbach Falls, the Adventure of the Empty Hearse, and he suppresses the Watson personality and does this stuff his own. But yet, even here, we see that the Watson personality is present in these stories. How? Why does Sherlock write them down? He's shown utter contempt for the fact that Watson is chronicling his life. He seems embarrassed by it. He doesn't like the fact that this is taking place. But yet he writes his own narrative anyway. Why? Because the Watson personality is still there in the background and is exerting enough control to be able to get Sherlock to write these down and do some things that Watson would do, but Sherlock would not do. You see the blending of these two.
So in the same way Watson can't get rid of Sherlock, Sherlock can't get rid of Watson.
Yes.
Now, I wonder if Sherlock took it to this next level, because being a good man himself, he knows that Watson, his other half, murdered an innocent man.
That's
and
right.
And Sherlock,
it could be,
is against that.
Yeah, it very well could be. So, as you can see from their different attempts, And by the way, we're painting a very different picture of their relationship. There is love and there is respect there, and that's genuine between the two. But there is also a rivalry and a hatred that lies beneath the surface and a desire to stamp one another out. But yet neither of them can do it. Neither of them can get rid of the other. The compromise that they eventually come to is one of the strangest things in the Sherlock canon. That Sherlock retires. Now, I don't care what reading you have of Sherlock Holmes, whether you want to take a straight reading, different alternative reading than what I'm buying, I think you have to come up with some explanation of why Sherlock retires, because I don't buy it for a second. It's unbelievable.
Talk about this, because now I haven't read the book. So how did they explain his retirement?
Oh, he's old. He's always wanted to retire. Nonsense. It is a direct contradiction of his character on many levels. First of all, within the canon, he's an obsessive character. The idea that Sherlock would ever quit is nonsense. However, from a modern perspective, and this isn't even within an alternate reading, this is just looking at the character within the Arthur Conan Doyle stories. He's likely mentally ill. He likely has some form of Asperger's or OCD or schizophrenia or something that gives him these incredible, seemingly godlike powers that he employs. But it also makes it impossible to believe that this man would quit. He loves what he does. Why does he take cocaine in the stories? It's not because he's an addict. It's because he's bored. This is somebody who's goes to the length of shooting up cocaine because he's bored. And you want me to believe that he's going to retire to the nice countryside in the summer? Not a chance. There is no chance Sherlock Holmes retires. He will do this till he drops dead on a case.
So this is the compromise.
This is the compromise.
And it's just that they'll coexist, but they'll stop doing detective work.
That's right. They will both take a step back. Watson will not live his life with his wife. He'll take that step back. He'll sacrifice his personal happiness. And in return, he also won't kill anyone else and won't try and suppress the Sherlock persona again. And Sherlock, in turn, won't suppress him. The two ride off into the night and eventually pass into the annals of history. Now, that's the narrative, but there's one major problem that we haven't taken on yet. And that would be Mycroft Holmes. Sherlock's brother?
Yes.
Well, first of all, I think it's important to note that outside of Mycroft Holmes, who does show up in a number of stories, there's no mention of his family except for one reference to his ancestors were squires or something like that. There's a very vague, offhanded reference. Besides that, we know nothing about Sherlock's family outside of Mycroft. Now, there's a couple solutions we could do here. First, we could posit that Mycroft is a third personality, but that I have a tough time buying that one because he doesn't stick around like the other two do. There's really no reason for him to emerge, and his job in the government would give him knowledge that Watson would not have simply as a third personality. I would rather suggest that Mycroft Holmes is a composite of a number of people within the British government whose identities must be kept secret. And for Watson to be able to chronicle, he needs to change their identities and create this composite character. Why do I say that? Well, Mycroft is presented as Sherlock's better, which is a little unbelievable that Sherlock is the lesser of the two Holmes brothers, considering how incredible he is. He is referred to not only as working for the British government, but, quote, at times he is the British government. He's somebody who possesses an incredible level of power and knowledge beyond what an ordinary human being could do. Therefore, but yet Sherlock also has some type of contempt for him. Even though he respects his powers, he has a level of contempt for him due to his laziness, his unwillingness to use them for the greater good in the way that Sherlock is. Thus, I think we're seeing a composite of a number of people and perhaps just general departments within the British government, but also a commentary from Dr. Watson on them about their inability, despite their great power and resources, to do more good with what they have been given. Thus, Mycroft Holmes does not exist either, but in a very different way than does Sherlock. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the strange case of Dr. Watson and Mr. Sherlock.
Oh my gosh.
Are you convinced yet?
That's amazing. So, wow. I mean, I've never read the books and I'm still captivated.
Yeah.
Now, do you, that question has to be asked, do you truly believe this?
Like, do I think Arthur Conan Doyle intended this?
I don't know. Okay, first that question.
No.
Okay, second question. Do you think, given what Arthur Conan Doyle presented with us, do you think this is the most obvious answer to this question? Or do you think it's just interesting?
I don't know about most obvious. I mean, anytime you're doing a secondary reading, it's a lot of this evidence, of course, is circumstantial.
Yeah.
It's taking pieces that you can interpret five different ways, each of them, and all interpreting them to point to the same direction. It's not that different than what a conspiracy theorist would do.
Now, you've talked to me about doing the audiobooks of Sherlock. You said that was a good experience.
Yeah.
I'm worried now that when I dive in, I'm just going to be imagining them as the same person.
Why not? That's part of the fun of it, you know? And I should also add, too, that I haven't, you know, I'm not a Sherlock obsessive. Many of these stories I've only read once. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you that there aren't details that I've missed that might contradict what I've talked about. Nevertheless, I think it fits, and I think it fits quite well.
Now, going back to what I started asking you earlier, when it comes to these mistakes in the text, when it comes to the wives or the wounds or where he's living, you just think that that's just flat out mistakes, not that there's anything fishy going on.
Oh, yeah. I mean, authors today make a lot of mistakes, and they have the benefit of computers and personal assistants. And, you know, when you're pounding this out by typewriter or writing it by hand or however Arthur Conan Doyle did it, you don't have that. You know, you don't have somebody whose job, the way that people like George R. R. Martin or Robert Jordan did when they're writing their massive series, of they have people whose job it is to catch mistakes like that. So I think it's just part and parcel of writing a long, sprawling series over decades, you know.
Wow. This episode is perfect. I'm asking you no more questions. But I'll let you get the last word. Do you have any last word?
I just would encourage people to get out there and read Sherlock. This is the fun of it. This is part of the fun of great literature, is diving in, dissecting stuff, reading it different ways. So if you haven't read Sherlock, go forth and do so.
I will.
All right.
I will, Ben. Ben, thank you.
You're welcome, sir.
I know that took a lot of research.
That was a fun episode.
Thank you for putting those notes together. That was amazing.
Well, thank you, sir. Thank you, sir.
Well, everybody, we'll be back next week with more of The Sci-Fi Christian. I'm Matt Anderson.
And I am Betty Bono.
We are The Sci-Fi Christians, signing off.
All right, goodbye.
All right,
man, what a great episode.
I know, I love it.
That was just a winner.
And I just want to thank the audience for indulging me in some ways, because, yes, this is one of our favorite episodes, but also I've been wanting to go back and re-listen to it. So,
well, who wouldn't?
I mean, if that doesn't say it's one of our best episodes, I don't know what does. I want to go back and listen just so I can be re-educated.
It's so good that I want to say what we say on Inside the Hoop. It was a slam dunk.
Yeah, I just remember really loving it back then, so I'm excited now to re-listen to it here again. What is it, 6 years later?
I don't even know.
Yeah, 6 years. Right. Yeah. So, listeners, thanks for joining us here tonight. That's all from here. I'm Matt Anderson.
I'm Ben DiBono.
And we're the Sci-Fi Christians, signing off.
Bye.